You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Maria Teresa Rojas, and I'm the director of the International Migration Initiative here at OSF. And I want to give a huge welcome to everyone on behalf of all of us at the foundation, and most particularly on behalf of the Justice Initiative and US programs who are co-sponsoring this event with the Migration Initiative. It's wonderful to see all of you. I know many of the people in the audience, and it's terrific to also see many of our colleagues from US programs. A big welcome to everyone. To have this type of stimulating and thoughtful discussion, no one better than Maria Hinojosa to help us achieve that. As many of you know, she is a renowned and award-winning journalist who, amongst the so many distinguished accomplishments, produced a frontline report on PBS last October called Lost in Detention, which of course covers deportation and immigration issues in the US, but she has extensive experience and knowledge about these issues more broadly. For me, I just wanted to welcome you at this moment, acknowledge Maria, and thank you for leading this conversation today. But I want to turn it over to my dear colleague, Archana Sehgal from the US programs, who oversees the immigration work. She'll introduce the rest of our panel and welcome you as well. Thank you, and looking forward to your participation. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria Teresa. On behalf of US programs, my colleague Luisa Taveras and I are delighted to co-host this forum with the International Migration Initiative and the Open Society Justice Initiative. This issue challenges advocates, grant makers, policymakers, given the national and international ramifications. And yet, this also serves as an opportunity to strengthen our analysis and collaboration across borders and expertise. This forum coincides with some very recent, very high-profile press coverage. You may have seen yesterday in the New York Times an article about Greece's plan to build a detention center for over 30,000 immigrants. What's striking about the article was that the detained immigrant population would far outnumber Greece's current prison population. And today in Washington, D.C., the Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on new immigration detention standards recently issued by ICE, cynically titled Holiday on ICE. This hearing reflects Chairman Lamar Smith's allegation that the new standards, one, set minimum requirements for medical care, two, access to counsel, and three, around other living conditions. He considers them a hospitality guideline for detained immigrants. Thank goodness the New York Times editorial board this morning appropriately titled the article, Detention is No Holiday. We are thrilled that Michael Flynn with the Global Detention Project can join us. Mike is based in Geneva and a well-regarded policy expert on detention issues. We're also delighted to have Grant Mitchell from the International Detention Coalition here. As ED of the coalition, Grant brings a unique perspective on the opportunities and risks of alternatives to detention policies. And finally, we're joined by Andrea Black, former Open Society Criminal Justice Fellow and current Executive Director of the Detention Watch Network. Andrea brings a cohesive approach to detention advocacy in the United States. And with that, I'll turn it over to Maria Hinojosa. So please join me in thanking all of our panelists.
So when we first of all, thank you for being here, and I'm so glad that OSI is having this conversation to all the panelists, and we are going to try to make this conversational. But I was thinking back about when we finally started getting some yeses back from the Department of Homeland Security about getting our access to the detention centers in the process of making the frontline. And frankly, were it not for the fact that we were with frontline and they knew that we were not going to go away, I think that they would have just wanted us to kind of go away and probably not give us access. But the first place that we went to was the Orange County Jail, which has some space out, has this space reserved for the immigrant detainees. And we had been told that it was considered like the country club, of detention. And considering that that's where we started, and then we went to Chrome in Miami, and we ended up in Willacy, it was a country club. But, you know, even though the doors were open to the two large pods, so you saw sunlight and you could, it made it seem the day that we were there that you could go out and play soccer and then come back. I remember, and this was my first detention center visiting, and I just, you know, the whole notion of all of these men being in bunks in a large space like this. And sometimes when I'm a journalist, what I do is that I play, that's true, naive, you know, because I didn't understand. So I asked the question to this very big man who was one of the wardens who was giving us the tour, and I was like, so what about this notion of kind of not having any privacy and the men just kind of sleeping on top of each other? And he looked at me very, very plainly and said, well, it's really good for their socialization. This is very good for their socialization. And I believe that he really believed it, too. And I suppose that if you fast forward to looking at the solitary confinement cells where detainees are placed, yeah, it is better for their socialization. But somehow, in his mind, he had worked this out, that this was the best place for them to be, even though they were wearing the prison jumpsuits. And I remember just saying, well, but why are they wearing prison? They're not in prison, right? Why are they wearing prison? Oh, well, you know, and that question almost, you know, just kind of passed over. And then I think about the conditions of what we experienced at Willacy. And I think that, you know, the fact that at that point it was our last detention center, and the truth is that at every detention center I was talking to as many people as I possibly could, but by the time we got to Willacy, they did this to me, and they just said, if you speak to anyone at all, you will be escorted off of the premises. So clearly something had happened between Orange County, Chrome, and by the time we got to Willacy. I am really, really happy that we're having this conversation because I'm not an advocate, but as a journalist, it certainly came this question of, are we just going to fix the detention problem by making them nicer? And is that really the answer when we have the largest population of civilly detained people? So I'm going to start by actually throwing a question out to Grant. And whether or not you think that that there is, in fact, a contradiction in terms of advocating for better detention standards versus a broader conversation, which is the necessity of detention.
Thank you. I think there's a tension. There's an innate tension. I don't think that it's insurmountable. I think we can't separate the two. The fact is that, you know, many of us here are in this field working because we want to see an end, a limiting, a prevention of immigration detention. But what do we do for those that languish in detention while that's happening? So it's been such a kind of an internal struggle. I mean, we have members, we're an international network with members in 50 countries. We've visited detention centres around the world. Civil society groups, UN and others are really struggling with this question. So this is the first time, actually, there's been a public forum on this issue. So it's fantastic we can get some feedback on what everyone thinks. But
let me ask you why you think that this is the first time that this kind of conversation has happened.
It's funny, from a civil society perspective, I have often seen two different responses. In some countries, groups have focused very much on conditions. In places like Egypt and Malaysia, that's as far as the dialogue will go. In other places, you know, the discussion is much more around dismantling reform, trying to look at alternatives to detention. So in a sense, I think there's been a polarization. And somehow, I think we as civil society and our partners, academic and others, need to be far more sophisticated on this issue. We have to have a much broader vision of change, of limiting detention, but we can't just focus on one or the other. There's just a very brief anecdote. I mean, there's an ethically challenging component to this for us as civil society or anyone like you visiting detention, because you see such horrendous things, you have to do something. And I was we've been working in Malaysia, which is the biggest detainer of undocumented migrants and asylum seekers in Southeast Asia. We were given access by the government to two detention centres a few months ago, and we were the first international NGO to be given access. We could talk to the detainees. We had quite free, unfettered access. People were literally in wire cages. They were out in the elements. There was no blankets, nothing to sleep on. Families separated. You know, people very ill from not being given clean water. The government then, at the end of that meeting, said to us, because they saw that we were wanting to engage them, they said, well, would you train us on how to run this detention centre? Would you help us write a standard operating procedure? Now, of course, part of my brain is thinking, oh, we have to do something. My other part thought, I'm not going to give a gold stamp as our organisation to, because the improvements would not be ever to the international human rights standards, because they haven't signed the various human rights conventions in Malaysia. So that was such an ethical dilemma for us. And these are the kinds of dilemmas that we're faced. We can't let people languish, but we can't be co-opted by governments.
All right, Mike, so what about your sense of the tension that exists on advocating for better detention or not? And you wanted to bring in the international perspective as well.
Yeah, well, I'll make clear that I'm not certain how many people read the discussion notes that have been distributed as part of this discussion today, but I focused very heavily on, I mentioned the United States up front, but the lessons that I'm drawing are international and almost to a great extent European. Because when you look over the last 20 years in Europe and the Council of Europe in particular, the member states of the Council of Europe, you see that they've transitioned from using prisons to dedicated immigration detention facilities during this time period. And you also see during this time period a measurable increase in the number of people being detained in these countries. So it raises an immediate question. Is there a connection between this movement to a formal detention infrastructure and the increased use of this policy or this practice? And one of the things that you find out when you look closely is that you see these human rights bodies, like the Council of Europe, going into states and saying, almost systematically saying to them, listen, you can't detain asylum seekers in prisons. You have to detain them in dedicated facilities. And you see this over 20 years of advocacy by the Council of Europe on this issue, and particularly the Committee for the Prevention of Torture. And it's quite remarkable, because that statement's being made in the absence of a statement underscoring that detention itself should be a last resort. So the issue of the right to liberty sort of got dropped out of the discussion, and the discussion became very heavily focused on how can we do this in a humane way. And it presents a big problem. And it was that problem that I'm addressing in the paper, and that I'm really happy that we're having this discussion of today. In the US case, it's very difficult to address the issue in the same way, because the United States has used prisons for such a long time, and it's such a massive problem. The Obama administration has taken steps to restrict the number of prisons, and they've replaced them with places like Carnes, which gets pushed back by people like Lamar Smith. So you have a dynamic here that is a bit of an outlier compared to other Western liberal democracies. But I think one of the things that needs to be focused on, as Grant says, these two issues are the conditions of detention and the proper treatment of detainees cannot be separated from issues of right to liberty. Nevertheless, states, I think, if you look broadly, states will respond to issues of improving conditions as not necessarily low cost in terms of money, but low cost in terms of policy. They can focus on conditions and say, look how we're improving this. And it provides what I call normative cover to increasing detention efforts. And the thing that I would say is it's important to be cautious that when you're advocating for improvements in conditions, that you're trying to do it in a way that focuses on detention as being a last resort. It's a very complicated issue to do, especially in the United States.
All right, and Andrea, I'm sure you want to comment on that, but I also wonder what your sense is in terms of depending on the monitoring right? And who's doing the monitoring, and is it independent enough, and how that plays into the conversation.
So I'd love to talk about monitoring, but if you don't mind, I would actually
go for it. You can talk about monitoring in a second.
We're also very excited that we're having this conversation. I mean, this is actually something that our members are grappling with and talk about quite a lot. But we haven't had the opportunity necessarily in this kind of forum to have this conversation. So Detention Watch Network, as many of you know, is a national coalition. We have over 100 organizational members around the country coming from very different perspectives, many of whom have been working at this, you know, since the early, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, all the way to, you know, people that are just getting into work around this issue as this issue becomes more exposed. And so we see that there's a tension, and there's a connection, and that really moving towards this idea that we must begin to dismantle the system, and but that urgent reforms are critical to that. And so it's really a question of how do we do this? What is the strategic framework? What is the messaging that we put out? And how can we work in a very close, coordinated way? Because we cannot stop addressing the immediate urgent reforms. I mean, we have members of DWN who are directly impacted themselves, have family members that are directly impacted, and, you know, very much, you know, very rightfully telling us, you know, you cannot turn your backs on people who are on detention right now and what they're suffering in order to, you know, go off into this, you know, long-term, you know, policy goal. And yet we can't just make a prettier cage, right? And so really I think our members are moving towards this, and we're really trying to actually look to, you know, the prison abolition field as an example of how they talk about non-reformist reforms and how they talk about urgent reforms on a path towards, you know, this either detention as a last resort or ending detention. And, you know, what does that look like? And that it is possible. And a lot of it is in the strategies you use, the messaging, what kind of reforms you talk about, and how you make sure that you don't pit certain groups against each other. And so we really think that it is possible, and you can bring a lot of people along to that, but that you really do need this bigger framework. And so very excited that the, you know, International Migration Initiative is really asking this question, because I think it's like only if we frame big can we begin to get what we want. And I think we've seen that in other debates in the U.S. I mean, if we frame too timidly, then we really don't get what we're looking for, right? And so what is the strategic framework we're looking for?
But let me ask you this question, because there might be some people who say, and, you know, for people who talk about this work outside of people within this work, and sometimes they'll be like, what are you talking about? You know, what do you mean detention centers? At the most basic level. And sometimes I talk about the importance of giving visibility. Like, visibility is the first step.
Yeah.
In a way, we're not at the visibility step in the United States. Most of these detention centers, as you know, are far off. And if you don't know an immigrant, you don't even know. So is it going too fast, or is that the way it needs to go?
Believe me, I've been doing this for 16 years, and while it's very much visible to me, I come across people every single day that still do not know that this system exists. And so it is. I mean, I sit on the plane next to people and have this conversation. So I agree that it is the visibility, right? But again, it's this framework that we use, and how do we very much need to be working in coordination. We need to have a lot of people doing much more work around visibility. And so I think the PBS documentary was a fantastic boost to these efforts. We need to have much more people doing visitation programs, presentations to churches. I mean, we can have that whole conversation, but how can we be inculcated in thinking, you know, we don't just say, you know, it is about exposed, but then people say, well, what should we do? You know, what is our answer about what we do? And how you might not be able to, you know, the media messaging can't be to that for this point, but how do you talk about media messaging that goes from point to point to point that gets you there, and you don't start talking in a way that's limiting you from those longer reforms down the road? And I think that's what our network has really grappled with, and I don't know if what your experience is internationally. I mean, you know, how do you actually, you know, frame the debate and frame the policy demands so they don't hurt you for the long term?
And let me just ask, as you guys contemplate that question, have you seen, in all of the years that you've been doing this work, have you seen a measurable change in terms of the media and its response?
Definitely. Oh, my gosh, yes. We've seen an incredible amount of media, but the problem is it doesn't stick. That it's not, we don't have, it's not sticking with the public. It's not grabbing people.
Because it's very locally.
Well, no, this is a question. I have to say, the number of people that are getting involved, I mean, the number of, and I see this a lot with the faith community, I mean, the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran Church, just as a few examples, are actually widespread, you know, they are starting to take this up as a serious issue. I went to the United Methodist Women Conference, 4,000 women, you know, in St. Louis a couple of years ago, and they took this on as their main issue, you know, and did rallies in the street. That was something that I never would have seen 10 years ago. So again, when you see, I mean, I think you can look at other social change movements, you know, you have to, it's a core group and you see the rippling effect outward. I definitely see the rippling effect outwards, but there's not the tipping point to the public. And so I think to what extent. But somebody asked me this about media, I mean, saying, well, there hasn't been anything, and I can actually list, you know, and I think Judy Rabinowitz, who's in the audience, can remember, you know, back in 1996, there were articles about immigration detention, right? What is going to get the stickiness to the public that will actually create the change? And I think, you know, how do we create those conversations and that, that the shock to the conscience that really gets people to say we need to do something?
I wonder about what, I think it was you, Mike, who brought up some of the core issue of right to liberty. And along with that, I would also put due process or the lack of due process. Is this part of, should the whole issue of due process be elevated or the lack of due process be elevated in the conversation as well? And are we, because that was one of the things that we thought a lot about in terms of the frontline. And I mean, I am frankly floored as an American citizen who became one in the late 80s. I am floored by the lack of due process and how some this is allowed to exist in our country, and it's because it's those people.
I think that the issue of due process and other legal guarantees and or the lack of these guarantees with administrative detention is an important focal point or potential focal point for people that want to campaign on this issue, because to the extent that states are being pressured to stick to provide systematically these kinds of legal guarantees, they will find that it's too expensive to detain too many people. So that's a rule of law perspective that could be adopted and focused on, perhaps in some states, not all, to help try to advocate for limitation, the limiting of this particular practice. If you are systematically saying you cannot be detaining these people in an arbitrary fashion, people have been saying this all over the world for a very long time. But issues like providing due process, if the state is being pressured, and I'm not an advocate or a lobbyist, so I can't tell you exactly how to go about doing this. But to the extent that a state is trying to do this, it will find that it does not want to detain increasing numbers of people because it'll be too expensive to do so.
So let's talk for a second about the issue of monitoring, just because. You know, in your situation, Grant, you were basically put in that position of like, well, you can help us. And then suddenly you're like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm fascinated by, you know, again, in our frontline, in terms of Willacy, they got a passing grade. They got passing grades in terms of their audits. The private company that monitored them based in Chicago, and I really wanted to go see their offices, like, who are these people? Who are they? That was incredibly distressing. And yet, who can hold them accountable? What, you know, they said, hey, our process was, and they, fine. So what about this issue? Your sense of being pulled into, okay, this monitoring, or somehow that the monitoring says it's fine?
Well, I definitely think it depends on who's doing the monitoring and what are the metrics. And so, I mean, I think we've been arguing for many years that, first of all, there needs to be legally enforceable standards. So really what they're using now are guidelines, and there's no way to step outside. I mean, they're basically monitoring themselves, right? And so until you have an independent authority who's actually going in and doing the monitoring and asking the right questions, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to have good monitoring. I mean, so some of the questions they ask are how many, you know, complaint slips have been filed and were they responded to in 3 days. They don't say what were the complaints. They don't say, you know, how were they resolved, and they don't say was there a pattern. I mean, it's very much based on this, you know, kind of in and out accounting system. But I also think that in addition to that, so I mean, you know, and that's very clear, independent, you know, third party monitoring, enforceable standards, and in addition, just other ways and that civil society can be involved. And so I think definitely the outside monitoring, we're very excited that they actually have new visitation standards. And I don't know how this is, you know, in the international context. But now, in theory, and we're trying to test this, you know, anybody can now go into a detention center, you know, if they are able to explain, and on pretty short notice, relatively speaking. I mean, after all the troubles you had getting into detention, but on 2-week notice, and you're allowed to talk to anyone, you can put up a notice and supposedly talk to anyone in detention. So now, I mean, this has been a very hidden system, right? Really, there's been no sunlight, right? So if we can begin to have outside groups from whatever dimension go in, I think that can also be very helpful. And then we really think that visitation programs, ongoing programs where people go in and develop friendships and support, who can be not only the eyes and ears, but it also helps bring in people in the public, because we know what a transformational experience it is when somebody goes into detention. And so I think there are several, when we talk about monitoring, I mean, there's a very specific, you know, there's a technical way to do it, but we also think that there's just really bringing the public presence to this very, you know, isolating system. And I don't know what it's like.
So can I just ask you, so the times that you've been in, because one of the things that struck me was when we went to Willacy and they were very proud to show us, mm-hmm. even though we were not allowed to speak to anybody, but the complaint box, there was a complaint box. It was nailed shut. There was no slit. I know, everybody's like, what? There was a complaint box, but you could not, there was no way to put anything in the complaint box. Like, you would have had to go to the guard and say, I want to put a note in the complaint box. Please open it up for me. Who's going to do that? So I'm sorry. I was just
great visual.
I was just taken. Yeah, it was and this was them letting us into a place that they had already scouted and allowed us to go into. So you have to wonder about that. So what opportunities do you think exist in terms of civil society? I mean, so now more visitation programs, and then there's a part of me that's like, oh God, you know what, just more visitation programs that, like,
I guess I'd just say that's not the only thing. It's more visitation to then get more people who are radicalized, who are then willing to take the step to say this is wrong. It's very much a coordinated, I just want to be really clear, it's not that on its own. And again, that's like, you want to monitor the system that exists as you're trying to put an end to it. And so that's why you need these different components. Okay. That's just, yeah, okay. All right.
I mean, from an international perspective, I mean, monitoring conditions is both to ensure the human rights of those that are detained, but it's also from an advocacy perspective, it exposes an issue, and it actually exposes whether international human rights standards are being upheld or not. So, I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, there's no one international human rights document for immigration detention, for people detained for migration-related reasons. There's like 50 different guidelines and documents that we found governments often don't know what are the international standards, which is why we actually collated them as one kind of set checklist, because I don't see any ethical dilemma at all in going into a detention centre and monitoring to see if they are upholding international and nationally accepted standards, and then reporting on that. And as you said, it needs to be public and transparent. And then there's a whole other element to that around prevention. I mean, this kind of having a presence in detention both can prevent human rights abuses, change a culture, help to identify vulnerable groups, which then can lead to release and reform. But your question about civil society, I mean, we're seeing civil society doing amazing things in so many countries, the US and DWN included. I think the frustration for us is how this issue gets so localized. Immigration detention is not a national issue. If it's not just a US issue, it's a Mexican issue, it's a Canadian issue. The Canadian law is about to change and it's looking very similar to US. And it's a ripple on domino effect. And it's been frustrating for us to see. You know, we were talking about this earlier. We were in Mexico a few months ago with OSF, running a workshop, and you know, groups in on the Mexican border who were doing almost identical work to NGOs and civil society across the border with the same populations moving had never had contact with each other. So there's a real need, I think, for civil society to see that these governments are working together. Governments are, the US policy is influencing firstly the whole world, but particularly our neighbouring countries. My country, Australia, talking about conditions, Australia has improved its conditions. In 2005, we started our reform process. You started in 2008. Here we are, what is it, 7 years later. There's been a whole range of improvements to conditions, but what is Australia doing? We're now paying for detention centres in our neighbouring countries. So we literally use our overseas aid humanitarian funding that should go to disasters to fund detention centres in Indonesia, where last month one of the guards was charged for torturing one of the detainees in a country that has not signed the majority of human rights conventions. So
what happened to the Australian advocates? Did they feel like, oh my God, what just happened here? We lost the battle? What do you know?
I'm seeing a lot of synergies and similarities, and I think a discussion to have is about immigration detention reform. There's only been about 5 immigration detention reforms around the world. The first one was in Sweden in 1996, and then there's been one recently in Belgium. There's a handful of countries. They've all achieved something. None of them have failed completely, but none of them have ended or limited detention or ensured that there is a prevention of those that should not be detained. So I think there's a lot of learnings. I think you're right. In Australia, there was an enthusiasm, maybe a complacency on some degree, because our reform went very quick. Now, in a sense, we feel we're back where we were 10 years ago.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, and I think that also goes to, I think for many of our members, really thinking about we need to push back against the larger criminalization frame. And I think looking at international, what is a system of international migration that allows the, movement of people just as we're allowing the movement of, goods and money. Can we really grapple with that at an international level? And we know that that's been incredibly hard, and that seems like a very daunting process, but until we really start to grapple with, what are fair laws in place, and how do we change the framework so that we're not talking about people who are, who are moving from country to country as criminals, that's part of it. So you can't just reform the system that is, how people are being detained, but it's why are people being detained and how are we looking at people? And I think that's been what's so dangerous. And I know in the U.S., and I know that we're unfortunately a bellwether of what's often to come, but not that there hasn't been criminalization, in other countries as well, but it's that criminalization framework and that sense of otherness that doesn't allow for any positive change. And I think that's part of what we understand that we have to grapple with.
So, Mike, by focusing on improving conditions, do people essentially end up helping governments to rationalize what they're doing?
I'll answer the question by picking up on a point that Grant just mentioned regarding the different reforms in different parts of the world and how they've been undertaken. One case stands out only because it was very recent that we saw a presentation on this. It was Belgium. At a UN forum last week, sponsored by the IDC, the a representative of the Belgian Ministry of Foreign Affairs or Interior discussed the alternatives to family detention. And what was interesting about the Belgium case was, and I think instructive for advocates wanting to both improve and limit this issue, is that when they introduced alternatives for families, they created this alternative structure, they had homes in the community, and at the same time, they eliminated and prohibited first instance detention of families. And it's that kind of example that works. Because when you institute alternatives, or alternatives for a small grouping, or a specific grouping of individuals, at the same time you have some kind of quasi or firm legal prohibition on detaining them, then alternatives becomes something that can be very, very constructive.
Do alternatives to migration themselves, I actually love this question, it was from my OSI friends, do the alternatives to migration themselves become another form of detention? That, right, it's a lot better, but you're not free.
I think it's very important to have clear definitions. Mm-hmm. And at the Global Detention Project, we have a very specific definition, which sometimes is a little bit limiting. but it's deprivation of liberty is defined as being forcibly enclosed in a space. There has to be some element of force that keeps you in a defined space. Absent that element of force or coercion, there can be lots of different penalties for leaving, but it's not detention. So, for instance, in Switzerland, where I live, there are, and all over Europe, there are reception centers for asylum seekers. And when you go from country to country and look at these reception facilities, you see that there's differing levels of deprivation of liberty or limitations on freedom. Some of these facilities will lock people behind closed doors for a few days initially, and then as they go through the process, allow them to leave the facility. But they have to be back by 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And if they're not back by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, then they basically forfeit their asylum claim and go immediately into removal proceedings once they're reapprehended. So this is obviously, that's a penalty. It's a very sharp restriction on the freedom of that person, but it's not detention. So by applying that definition, this use of this element of coercion, you can circumscribe what detention is, what deprivation of liberty is. So we do that systematically. Others like to talk about detention in terms of not being able to leave a particular area of a country. There's lots of complications, too. What about if it's a person that's in an airport terminal and can't leave that terminal? They're stuck there, and there are cases of this. That terminal becomes a detention space for them, but it's a very odd kind of detention space because it sort of turns the notion of detention, deprivation of liberty, incarceration on its head, which is taking an element of society and removing it from society. These are people that are actually wandering around with other people that are not detained. So there's lots of complications with the issue, but there are you can develop a very circumscribed notion, which I would suggest doing.
I mean, for us, I mean, there's two things. There's alternatives to detention, which we see as people having freedom of movement in the community while their case is being processed. Then there are alternative forms of detention, and that's where the US, it becomes a big blur, and other countries like Australia as well. I mean, you have this electronic tagging and other bracelets and there are other models around curfews and so on. And it becomes very confusing. For us, any kind of restriction on liberty becomes a place of detention for us, or a status of detention, not necessarily a place. And governments often fudge that. I mean, they will say, oh, yes, we use alternatives. We have so many thousands of people in alternative programs in the community, but you actually analyze it. And they're creating new forms of detention, so to speak. So for us, I think it's been really important to actually map out and look at those freedom of movement models, the right to liberty models, the prevention models, and there's some very creative ways governments are. I mean, when people think alternatives, they think, oh, electronic bracelet, oh, they have to report to the police, they have to do telephonic monitoring. That is kind of last resort in what we identified around the world. We saw a whole lot of other ways that when someone's intercepted at an expert meeting last week in Geneva at the UN, it was all about border, interception at the border. And these creative ways states are actually identifying, doing screening of security, health very quickly right at the border outside of any physical place of detention, and then making an informed decision, how states can actually still feel that they have some control over the border, but they're not using a default position of detention. So it's trying to we've tried to spin this alternative to detention debate on its head. How do we prevent, even alternatives should be the last resort. It should be prevention and liberty first, and then move down kind of a succession of other models.
So we're going to open it up to questions, but before we do that, just to you, Andrea. So apart from you, you're an amazing leader in the United States, right? But let's just say in terms of the kind of leadership that we would need in the United States to really push the conversation that says, you know, detention must stop, for example. Not that there should be alternatives, but there should, you know, we should really consider it. Is there that leadership anywhere in our sphere? I'm thinking about the noted silence on the part of the president. Mm-hmm. So people were expecting something from the president. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Maybe. And I'm not expecting that there might be an answer.
We're at a very difficult time. I mean, thank you. And I mean, I'm a representative here of 100 organizations and, you know, membership groups around the country. So there are a lot of people that are involved in this. I feel very privileged to be here, you know, speaking on their behalf. And we do feel, I mean, leadership, I do feel like needs to come. We're not going to get the leadership that we need on many of the issues that, you know, that are that are important for me and others right now in the current climate, but particularly on detention and immigration. I mean, there is a vacuum, and there's a very active anti-immigrant force at work, both within Congress as well as within our, you know, the broader community. And so there's a lot of groundwork that needs to happen, and we're not going to come up with a solution in the next 1 to 2 years, right? You know, we understand that. And so the question is, how do you start to build? How do you start to create leaders? And I see leadership coming from immigrant communities. I mean, they have been the leaders for forever on this. Faith communities. Allies working in the criminal justice system. I think people with elected local officials. I mean, in Austin, we're getting close to the city council actually passing a resolution to stop ICE enforcement. We've already had a lot of the elected officials speak up about this, and you're seeing that across the country. And so again, I do think it is this exposure piece. So more and more people need to know, and we need a bigger megaphone to get that out. As well as really the groundwork, the groundswell that needs to come from communities so that elected officials feel like they have to take a stand and that it's actually politically safe. Because right now I understand that it's incredibly hard for the president to take action in the current environment. So I do feel like there is that combination of, you know, exposure and then ability to then, you know, take the conversation out and turn it into political action. So there is no leader, but I do see a path towards changing.
Although I would disagree with you, I actually think that the president absolutely could be the leader on this. I think he could, in fact, be the one who changes and frames the conversation in a different way. I think he chooses not to, for all kinds of reasons. But yes, go ahead. You want to stand to the mic? Yes, you, sir.
I'm Bob Manley with the Church and Society Committee of the First Presbyterian Trinity Church in South Orange, New Jersey. Also founder and president of the Center for Global Responsibility. Sitting next to me there is Linda Lubinsky, co-convener of that Church and Society Committee and executive director of the Center for Global Responsibility. I would want to say quickly that some people would regard me as conflicted, having been a judge advocate in the Air Force, having been a lawyer for the New York State Thruway Authority, working closely with the New York State Police, sometimes on toll collector fraud, but sometimes on getting toll collectors out of the system because they were outrageous sometimes with patrons. Anyway, the Center for Global Responsibility is definitely a human rights-oriented outfit, and so is that committee of that church. But I don't think anybody here is speaking a word about the question of reasons for detention and statistical stuff. I don't have the statistics. I don't work for ICE. I don't advocate for ICE. I advocate for the detainees, but I don't think it's possible to have an informed discussion of this without somebody, which has not happened so far, talking about what the percentages are of people, not detainees, who are notified that they are in violation of this, that, or the other, overstaying a visa or whatever, not in any kind of detention, not with an electronic bracelet, or anything like that, what percentage of those folks, and of course it varies also from the country they came from, the feds have a lot of information on that, what percentage are from one country are liable to overstay and what percentage are not, and so forth. I don't think this is an informed discussion.
But I'm not understanding your question. What, can you just tell me what your question is?
If you don't know, you don't know. What I'm saying is that nobody here is saying a damn thing about the perhaps bona fide reasons for detention. Nobody's saying a word about the percentage of people who, if they're not detainees, will be going underground or whatever. Without that discussion, an informed discussion, this is a totally nebulous and feel-good discussion, but not a real discussion.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mike.
I think you raise some critical issues. For instance, statistics on the issue of detention, or on the issue of release, or on the issue of the numbers of people proportionally that are being detained in different countries, is very inadequate and almost doesn't exist in a lot of countries. So that's a very important point to underscore. I don't think that's necessarily the point that you're after, but I think that we need a reliable picture, and it hasn't been created yet, and there's lots of reasons why it hasn't been, partly because governments are very tight-fisted with this information or don't even collect this information. So yes, that is a real issue. With respect to the legitimate grounds for detention, that's a very difficult question. I mean, if the state feels that it has to surveil and know every individual in that country as if that were a matter of security, then clearly that's going to be an impulse to detain more people. And that is an issue that's always existed and always will exist. The issue is, does the state have a bona fide concern in that respect? It shouldn't begin by saying it's a problem. It should begin by saying, is it a problem if there are people that we haven't identified and surveilled? I think that's the kind of question that should be asked before we say, what are the bona fide reasons for detaining? I think it's a question that needs to be addressed, and it's not an easy one, but anyhow.
Right, because the big question in this country is you have a right to liberty, right? At least. That's the assumption in this country that you have that right. You wanted to jump in, Grant.
I'm just going to say, I mean, that's the reasons the government detained is like the first question we ask when we go to a country. I mean, and it differs so much. We've been working in Israel where they've just introduced new anti-infiltration legislation. So you're not just criminalized, but you're an enemy of the state and treated as such if you enter without a document. And a part of that is building the world's biggest, well, at the moment, world's biggest detention center, 10,000 people. That in that case, they're using detention to deter, to stop new arrivals. That's what Australia did as well. It's like, hey, let's be as tough as possible. In looking at the research on that, there's no evidence that detention centres deter, and actually I've got the research at the back here. But the other reasons they detain is around security. People turning up with no identification documents, thinking individuals will disappear, will abscond, or around ensuring they'll be deported. Now, what's also interesting, and I was touching on that with the research, is that there's a whole range of mechanisms internationally where each of those elements are being dealt with, from people needing to leave the country, assessing and identifying who is a security risk, who is a flight risk, without using detention. And I think that's been our engagement with government. We have to address the legitimate concerns of government and challenge those that are not legitimate, like deterrence. But it has to be evidence-based.
Yes, go ahead.
Madeleine Crone. I work with the Global Campaign for Pretrial Justice. We focus on what I call garden variety criminal cases. And I'm with the Justice Initiative. A quick comment and a question. Very early on, you talked about getting the issue to stick. And I think one of the problems that we face in the criminal justice reform, and possibly also in your campaign concerning immigration, is that we deal with a population that is not popular. They're all criminals. They should even presume innocent. They should just stay there. They should be locked up and so on. So that's an issue that's difficult to grapple with. The question is this. As you know, and I read some of the papers, if you build them, you will fill them. Similar issue in both of our topics of interest. To what extent has there been some investigation, some documentation of the monetary incentive to build prisons? It's worldwide. It leads to lobbies. Legislators agree. And I could go on into some of the less savory aspects of these mafias.
You know what? Actually, I'm going to go ahead and take your question. Thank you for your question. And go ahead and take your question, and then we can answer two at the same time.
Yeah, young lady, you mentioned pathway to all this. It has to be around commonality. I mean, where's the constitution? Where's the challenge of the constitutionality in anyone's sovereignty? I mean, in Syria, I mean, they didn't ask to be immigrants and or refugees when they moved to Lebanon. They're in the middle of a war, a civil war with it. Cuban Five has been detained since I've been in high school, and they're still in jail. The issue to me is about commonality between all these situations. I mean, where is the challenge of the constitutionality of these people's sovereignty to begin with? Who is speaking up, internationally speaking, law in regards to, you know, how this is proceeding? I mean, are any of us really free? We get police surveillance in here in Harlem, where I live. I mean, are any of us really free?
Oh boy, 110. Let's get Nietzsche, Kierkegaard. We'll take it from there. Thank you for that. I do think that there is an issue of commonality, of the bigger purpose, and then the bigger question around monetary incentive, what the compañera called the new mafia. Comments? You want to?
I would say that the monetary incentive. There's perhaps two issues, right? One is the privatization of jails and prisons and detention centers. But maybe there's even another issue, which you may or may not be talking about, which is not even necessarily privatization, but how there is government money that's spent to employ people to build detention centers and jails and run them, even if they're in the public sphere. Both these are operational in your question, I think. On the issue of privatization itself, this is a real issue. What's interesting about the issue from a global perspective is how, to a great extent, up until recently, it is a phenomena of the English language world. It is the UK, Australia, United States, South Africa. Interestingly enough, South Africa, the privatization was not Serco or some large global corporation. It was the ANC Women's League that got the contract to run its detention facility quite some time ago. But that's a real issue, privatization, and I think it has to be. Is there a connection between issue of this kind of privatization and increasing detention? I don't think that that's a point that can be proven at all. I don't think the data exists. I don't think there's enough examples out there to be able to actually say there's a connection between privatization and increasing numbers of detainees. I don't know. Because if you actually look at the case of Australia, correct me if I'm wrong, Grant, but I think that there was actually some decreases in detainee numbers after the system was privatized. So, but what's causing increases and decreases, and how do you measure patterns and trends over how many years are all very complicated questions. I think the larger concern with privatization is that you create a lobby with an incentive that has all kinds of ways of influencing public policy that are often not very transparent. And that notion of submitting this question to issues of private gain is inherently problematic. I think probably most of the people in the audience would agree that this is a problem. This should not be an issue that's actually in the discussion. The political economy of detention and the questions that we answer should not be revolving around, even if secretively, around issues of profit motives. So I think that's a problem. The larger issue of building prisons, having prison guards, is it a way the state can employ more people, and is there an incentive in that respect? I don't know. I haven't seen that kind of study. I would say that there is a complicated question in looking at whether or not detention helps serve another purpose. And I can't prove this, but I know that you'll probably find advocates in Mexico and some other countries who might agree with this, that it forces people underground to be hidden, and that has an economic benefit for the state. That's another level of discussion. I don't know if that can be provable or not, but that can be that's an element of that conversation.
Andrea, you wanted to jump in.
Well, just to say, I think absolutely we need more research on this. I mean, there has been some great research done. The ACLU has done released a report recently. The Detention Watch Network, we did some preliminary research that's on our website, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. I think there's been some great investigative journalism. NPR did a great story about the link between the lobbying and some of the legislation in Arizona, for example. But again, we don't have all the connective tissue. And I think it's a piece that's very important, both in terms of the private prison companies, but also then there's the issue of the incentives for local communities, both in terms of building the jails, but then also you look with these secure community programs turning to ICE because they can get a much higher daily rate for people detained than in their local area.
Detain that dog.
Oh my God.
Like, oh my gosh. Okay. I hope they're okay. So I would say this is a crucial area, and we really have not gotten enough, really had enough research done on this. So I would hope that we could. Okay.
I just think about when we did the interview with Mike Rosas, formerly with ICE. Who helped basically write Secure Communities and what he said in terms of keeping the population up. And he wasn't talking about filling the private detention centers, but he just said, well, if you have, and he basically said, we do have a quota, even though the administration is saying no. If you have a quota, you're taking the low-lying fruit, the high-flying fruit, and all the fruit in between, because you're going to meet that quota. Mm-hmm. And that quota, when you add the private element to it, means ka-ching, ka-ching. And so, you're making a profit off of a body in a cell. And I don't even think that concept, talk about another invisible concept, most people have no sense when you talk about a private prison, what you're talking about. A private detention center. Still, this notion amongst us, we get it, but out there, I think that most people are still shocked when they hear, what do you mean they're a private company? So again, another one of these, how do we even get to that point where we're talking about just educating, basically? But yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Judy Rabinovitz. I'm with the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, and I've been working on these issues for, I guess, about 20 years. I just wanted to make 2 points. One was coming back to sort of the topic here, which was sort of, is there a way that we can push for improving conditions while not sort of providing this cover and basically fueling more detention? And I agree with Andrea, and I guess with maybe Grant said it also, that look, exposing conditions is a way of drawing public attention to this issue that is, otherwise very hidden. And it's part of a step of building sort of opposition to and dismantling the system. At the same time, I think what we have to do whenever we call attention to conditions, and this is something we've tried to do because I'm focused mainly on litigation to challenge detention without due process, but then other parts of the ACLU are focused more on conditions. What we try to do is whenever we focus on conditions, also ask the question, why is this person detained in the first place? So when there's a death in detention, you're not only talking about the lack of medical care, you're saying, why was this person detained for a year when he posed no danger or flight risk? So I just think that's something that's incumbent on all of us when we're doing our advocacy about conditions to just at least make sure to ask that other question so that it's not just left there, but then it takes us to that other place.
It seems that you're saying that should be the very first question.
I think it has to be a question, whether it's the first question which draws somebody in. The first question that may draw somebody in is that somebody just died and they were abused and they were that. That's fine. But the next question, you can't leave it there. The next question has to be, why are we detaining them? Why was this person detained? This person was sexually abused. Why was she in detention? So we just can't stop there. I think that, as to the point of how, yes, it's true that, when you make these sort of cosmetic changes, it makes it more palatable. I mean, that's true with everything. Every reform that you make that's short of what we want, makes things more palatable. But we still want to make those reforms. So I think that the critical issue is just as we're making those reforms, we also highlight that other issue. And the only other point that I want to make is that when we talk about pulling back our framework and looking farther back, and when you raise the question of why are people detained, I think that we have to look at not only why are we detaining people? Is it necessary to detain them? But why are they being put into deportation proceedings? That's the reason they're being detained. They're being detained because of this huge, massive deportation machine right now. And, you know, a lot of that stems from the 1996 laws. Others of it stem from, you know, 9/11. But whatever, there's no way to divorce detention from those larger questions. And again, so I would say when detention's a good entry point, especially since we have all these sympathetic stories of people who are being detained and we don't, you know, they don't pose a danger of flight risk. So, you know, the first question you ask is, you know, why did they have to be detained? Are they a danger of flight risk? And then why are they in deportation proceedings to begin with? Why are we spending all this money, you know, to put them, you know, to deport them and to divide families? Well, I guess those things are obvious, but I think that they're just, and they're difficult. I mean, Andrea was saying, you know, look, are we going to tackle the whole immigration system and comprehensive immigration reform? It's difficult, but it is a process, and it's part of using detention as a way to start raising those larger issues.
I think about one of the interviews that did, well, one of the pieces of tape that didn't make it into the front line. This was Mark Krikorian, who you all know, who basically said something that I had never heard, which was, anyway, look, immigration was when the United States was in its adolescent period. We're a grown-up country now. We're past immigration. We're done with it. It's not a part of who we are anymore. And I was like, oh, okay, well, thanks for cluing me into the national conversation that you obviously have had and already determined. But when you kind of go back to that point of like, you know, how do we even, and that's such a much deeper conversation, right? How did we even get to this point? But thank you for raising that. And we're going to take another question and maybe another one and then bring it back to the panelists.
Okay, great. Thank you. Luisa Taveras, Program Officer with the Criminal Justice Fund, and I actually have two questions. One is for Andrea. If you could just say a little bit more about exactly what you mean when you say the criminalization frame, and then if Grant and Mitchell and Michael could comment on whether there's a similar phenomenon in the international context. And for Grant, you mentioned the need for governments to work across borders, such as the United States and Mexico, for example, since they're facing similar issues and similar populations. Can you talk about the need, if any, for advocates to work across borders? And if that's happening, give us some examples. If it's not, do you have any suggestions on how we can make it happen?
Let's bring that back. And who wants to go first in that list? Andrea, do you want to talk about the criminalization framework? And then we also have the notion that Judy brought up about the money issue and arguing this that it's just too expensive.
So, I mean, in terms of the criminalization frame, I think there are a couple of components to that. I mean, I think, you know, within the immigration context, I mean, we are looking at the fact that somebody who has crossed a border, someone who is here without permission, without documents, that in many ways has become a criminal offense, right? And we are taking people who are using false documents, et cetera, and they have given them criminal sanctions, or people who re-enter. But I think there's also a larger piece of criminalization, and why do we have this whole deportation system? I think in a bigger sense, I mean, the criminalization, I mean, for our members, I mean, we are looking at the way the U.S., the immigration detention deportation system has become part and is inextricably linked to the bigger issue of mass incarceration of people, mainly people of color and the poor in the U.S. And so how that the whole system of criminalization is actually playing into this larger issue and these questions of demographic change in the U.S., issues of social control. I mean, I know I'm getting very big and scary for maybe some people, but just to say, we need to be thinking about this. And so when we talk about criminalization, I mean, it's very clear, and it's not just people that are undocumented or who are now being criminalized, but it's people who've lived here as legal permanent residents all their lives since they were 3 months old and have their entire family here, and because of a past criminal conviction for which they've served their time, they're now facing a double jeopardy and an even more serious penalty of permanent exile because of this past criminal conviction. And so it's the whole system that's been created that says that this is okay. So again, I think we have to be very careful how we define the term, because I know that even within our community, we talk about criminalization and it means different things to different people. And so again, we don't do this all at once. This is not the, when I sit down and talk with, when I do a community presentation, this is not the first thing I start with. But I think it's, we need to be having some serious conversations among ourselves to really, within the community of advocates, to really talk about what it is we mean and how do we start to bring this conversation, into the public sphere. Because until we get to what I think the gentleman was talking about, the bigger issues of freedom, until we start to grapple with some of that and what does that mean to be America today, let alone an international context, all of this is going to be very small tweaks to a system. And we really have created this, this greater sense of criminality, that it's okay to put somebody in a prison, right? It's okay to make money off of that person. They don't count, is a really big question we have to grapple with.
Absolutely.
I mean, look, just in terms of the U.S. influence on other countries in terms of immigration detention, I mean, criminalization and securitization is, I mean, the U.S. immigration policy, just chunks of it are now in legislation around the world, and Mike was mentioning this kind of Anglo influence. It's so true, and the sad thing is to see countries like France, the neighbour of the UK, and our my neighbour Indonesia, they didn't have a tradition of detaining migrants in the way they have started to in the last 5 years, literally five plus years. We're seeing the same in this region. We're seeing the Caribbean becoming a mass detainer, everything from use of prisons to tying people to trees. We were hearing boats arriving and they're like, oh, we have to detain them. That wasn't... This first resort default position is becoming the norm. So, I mean, the monetary aspect is one element, but there's a whole underlying... And to answer the question about governments communicating to each other, governments already are communicating with each other. I mean, NGOs should be sophisticated and engaging across borders and working out transnational strategies, because governments are doing it and the NGOs, we're not up to par. We're not addressing... some of the bilateral, multilateral kind of decisions that are being made. And now we have just a really brief snapshot with the support of OSF and the International Migration Initiative. We were able to go out globally last year and do a consultation in every region of about 180 NGOs from 67 countries. So we have this snapshot now of what's happening. And the trends are so clear, and I hate to say it, but the US has had such a negative impact internationally. But there's a counter to that. The 2008 announcement, just the announcement of the reform, it's 2009, sorry, of the reform, triggered a counter. Like, when the US says it's going to reform an area of policy, it kind of triggers some interest. And some of the NGOs, like the IDC, we took advantage of that to actually start to engage. Now we're going to see a count that's going to backfire now, because the reform is kind of stuck, and governments are very aware of that. So so that's kind of in a nutshell.
Do you want to jump in, Mike, or do you want to take another?
Real briefly on the issue of criminalization, I think it's a real issue. You had asked to the extent to what you see it internationally. But one thing that is actually quite interesting in the discussion around criminalization is, as you point out, it's a word that is used by lots of different people to say lots of different things. On one level, the use of administrative detention is a form of criminalization because there's a perceived penalty there that people are paying. But when you look at, and we've looked at immigration and citizenship laws in some 80, 85 countries, if you look at the origins of these laws, almost all of them, without exception, are providing penalties 80, 90, 100 years ago for being in the country without authorization. So this notion that this is a new thing is not altogether real. To the extent that the United States has done some things recently in that effect, that's true. Italy has a law, which, interestingly enough, was found to be illegal by a European court quite recently. But I think it's quite—I think it's quite interesting, the conversation about criminalization, because to the extent that there's concerns that there will be more states doing this, that this will become a real phenomenon, I don't think that it's going to happen, for the very reason that by actually criminalizing unauthorized presence or entry, the state is going to have to pay too much money. It's much better to keep people in administrative detention than criminal, than put them in the criminal justice framework.
And you don't find states actually applying these penalties or what do exist in their citizenship laws very systematically for that very reason. It's very administrative detention is very convenient.
You know, it's interesting because we have a story running on PBS in the next couple of weeks where Texas, we're talking about jails now. Texas has closed for the first time in its history a jail because they've actually started to use alternatives to imprisonment for low-level drug offenders and giving them drug treatment. So the tough-on-crime state is now leading the reform because they can, because they're tough, you know? So nobody's going to be surprised if Texas decides to close a prison. But it's because they went so far to the right that now they can actually be leading the conversation and actually closing a prison. So it kind of is a weird way of coming back. And also, I was fascinated to end up in the Dominican Republic and be hearing the terminology and seeing the detention of Haitian immigrants. And Dominicans, where I've been for, you know, 20 years, I'm married to a Dominican man, had never heard the word, esos ilegales, and now all the Haitians are ilegales. And it's just like, where did they come up with? Well, they consume our media as well, and they hear what American policymakers are saying. Let's take 1, 2, 3 questions so that we can move it forward. So just briefly, just tell us your question.
Okay. Hi, Ellen Arisa from Human Rights First. Thanks so much to everyone for organizing this discussion. Some of what I was going to say was already touched on by Judy and others, but I wanted to weigh in from a perspective of an organization that actually only advocated on issues of the impropriety of mandatory detention and the need for more due process protections. And we actually also started advocating on the issue of conditions for a bunch of reasons that have been touched on now, but some of which was actually the input we got from people we were assisting, and we would talk with them during detention and afterwards about what were their biggest concerns about the system, and it was we're in prison uniforms, we were handcuffed, no privacy, all the kinds of things that we've all been talking about. So, you know, we thought that was a really important voice to take into our advocacy as we went forward. But, you know, the big challenge here is that what states don't want to do is detain less people. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and we've had a really rich discussion on it. I would love to hear more on, you know, looking forward a little bit about what we think some of the strategies are for overcoming the challenges globally, nationally, locally, the political challenges, whether it's, you know, the politics here in the U.S. of, you know, how immigration plays out in key swing states, the calculus between enforcement and broader immigration reform, globally, you know, xenophobia, racism, et cetera, the sense that individuals are who are migrants or others, aliens, don't have any rights, therefore, as well as more on how we can build more allies. Andrea touched on that. But, you know, are there fiscal conservatives? Are there others? I mean, we need allies and we need champions if we're going to deal with this. And this is a local issue, it's a national issue, and it's a global issue. Thanks.
Thank you. I think the money thing is really important. Go ahead and just give us your question as well.
Hi, my name is Katarina Obser. I'm with the Women's Refugee Commission. I also just want to thank you all for this very important conversation. And I wanted to ask a question about monitoring, which I know is something that Andrea talked about and you've all talked about a little bit. But I wanted to ask about it in a couple of ways. I think it's both certainly important to this idea of possibly changing conditions in the short term. It's something that here in the U.S. we have advocated for a long time to try to get better access to detention centers and to most importantly actually be able to speak to individuals who are in detention more freely, unlike in the way that you were, although I'm sorry, I don't think the new policy applies to media. So I think there's still restrictions there. But I wanted to also ask about it in the context of the issue of dehumanization and criminalization. I think that the more that NGOs and civil society and other groups are able to access facilities and talk to officials there and meet with detainees, the more we can also get at the access of how both officials at a facility see those individuals and whether we can try to change the perspective that these are human beings who should not be detained in what are very substandard conditions or not be detained at all, similarly to what's come up before, what Judy was saying, these are you know, survivors of domestic violence, for example, but also the local communities and changing perspective in local communities through these kind of monitoring visits. I think this is something we've had you know, frustratingly slow, though very tiny incremental progress with here in the U.S. And I was hoping to hear some international perspective on monitoring as well. What kind of best practices you've seen, what has worked and what hasn't, both for sort of international coalition organizations like yours, but also what you see with local civil society trying to access facilities. Thank you.
And we'll go ahead and take your question, too.
Thank you. Amy Gottlieb with American Friends Service Committee. Just want to pick up a little bit on what Eleanor was saying and kind of bring it down to the practical level a little bit, because I work mostly in New Jersey, and we recently had this huge explosion of detention in New Jersey, and the justification for much of it by ICE was, well, you asked us not to transfer people, so we're going to stop transferring people far away, and we're going to put them all close by so that we can have, you know, people closer to their families and closer to their lawyers, and, you know, here's 1,200 new beds, welcome, and we're going to build a new facility. And so my question, really, and Andrea and I have talked about this probably for hours, so I'm sorry, Andrea, you don't have to, I'll give you a pass. But in thinking about kind of the big coalition picture, how do we work together with organizations? For example, in that example that I just gave, you know, the Immigration Lawyers Association was glad to have their clients nearby, right? So they weren't going to come and sort of fight on these new beds, and we're sort of stuck both wanting to fight on the conditions, wanting to fight on, you know, access to counsel and sort of real issues that are the day-to-day issues, but at the same time needing to work in partnership with these organizations and us wanting desperately to be able to take the position that we have to do individualized determinations, we have to question why people are detained, and we want to fight back entirely on the system. And so, like, just expanding this conversation a little bit from the philosophical to the practical, and how do we negotiate some of those challenges? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Just like, you know, if they throw as many things possible at us, then we'll be like, you know, just always trying to catch up, and then you're going to take whatever, you know, the whole notion of, like, guest workers now should be something that, whoa, let's get guest workers. And it's like, really? Sorry, that was... I just, I mean, we all feel that way. I actually wanted to follow up on Jody's question, Andrea. You know, when you talked about, you said, we're having this conversation internally, and we have tensions internally. So as you answer that question, mm-hmm. what do those tensions actually look like? When you are with your groups, your people, what does this tension, this whole conversation that we're having, take us into that moment when that tension kind of erupts?
Okay, great question. Well, I mean, I think it's been a really interesting evolution. I mean, I've been, again, part of the network in one form or another since it started in 1997, and so I've seen the conversation evolve. And again, I think some of the tension is, it used to be about, is it conditions or is it, you know, what is the bigger picture? But I think we're actually, there is this united sense that it needs to be together. So I think that decision, at least among the coalition of groups working on this issue in the U.S., there is a sense that we need to do this together. How far we go? You know, is it an abolition frame or is it a detention as a last resort frame, I think is still being, you know, worked out. I think this issue of, you know, so how do we have the conversation? Do we hold up the most vulnerable in detention? You know, what is the face of the people that we bring forward first, I think has been some of the questions. And I think this issue of criminalization, too. I mean, do we talk about people with criminal convictions or not? But I have to say, I've seen this evolution. I mean, people who know me, I'm very much a process person, right? And I'm wanting to bring the community along. And I feel like the community has evolved and has gotten to the point where it's really, we need to stand up. We have to have solidarity for everybody in detention. We need to look at this in a much bigger frame. And actually, part of our challenge is working with, like, the larger immigrant rights movement, you know, to have this conversation and really engage them. Because again, there are communities within communities, right? So I think it's having that conversation to say, you know, what is this about and how can we be having these larger conversations? I mean, it's been very exciting that we're, you know, partnering with Open Society Foundation, both on the Opportunity Equality Fund, but also on the Criminal Justice Fund, and being able to have those conversations, bringing folks together across these communities to have some of these deeper conversations. So I think that's really also been helping change the conversation. I mean, at a very practical level, I mean, we have strategies that I can, you know, go through, but I think I'm talking on a more theoretical or abstract level just because I feel like I'm trying to highlight that piece, and I don't mean to be too vague, but it's that until we have those larger analytical conversations and framing conversations, it's, you know, the specifics that we go for are going to fall short. And so that's why You know, happy to talk strategies, et cetera, but I think we need to grapple with the frame. And so that's just domestically what we're dealing with. I don't know what it's like.
And let me just ask you before we move on. So, and are you, do you feel like on a daily basis you're operating, I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, but do you still feel that you're operating from a crisis mode? Or do you feel like, and is it a good thing that perhaps you're not operating from a crisis mode? Or is that in and of itself a problem, which is, well, you know, the wheels are turning and we're just, you know, a cog, another cog in the wheel?
I mean, on one hand, it's very much a crisis mode. I mean, and so people are in detention, you know, calling from detention every single day. We're talking to family members. I mean, it is an immediate crisis. It's also a crisis because, you know, we're being thrown anti-immigrant legislation every single day. And we can talk about the just the reams of bills, right? And, I mean, look at the, you know, the scrambling that people had to do around this hearing today. What's really exciting is that I'm seeing, I mean, again, a much larger, vibrant, diverse community of people that are working on this. And so the ability to work more proactively, I've seen grow exponentially. So I know that it may seem, you know, it does feel like the public attention is maybe not as well, you know, it's not as well known in the greater public, but I've seen the how it's ramped up, right? And the number of advocates who are working on detention and deportation issues in Washington, D.C. has probably, you know, there are 10 times more than there were, maybe because there are only like one or two in the past, and now there are 10, but that's huge, right? The number of, you know, community groups that are getting involved, the number of visitation programs went from 3 to 17 just in the last few years. So I see a huge trajectory. That, I think, is proactive, right? And so I think the detention campaigns in Florida and Texas and Illinois, fighting, and in New Jersey and New York, I mean, fighting against the new detention beds has been phenomenal. And they're actually making, I mean, it's been hard. New Jersey got the short end of the stick. It happened before people even had a chance to breathe. But in Texas and, Illinois and in Florida, they're making gains. They're actually, it looks like they might actually be able to turn back the new detention centers. So that I see, I feel like there's been more proactive, but it is, you know, we have to understand that it's still in the context of crisis. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The two questions were monitoring and best practices and strategies and political challenges. So,
yeah, just to continue on, I think what DWN is feeling in the U.S., we're feeling internationally. I don't think there's any difference. I think, and equally, we've been trying to see what has worked. What has worked in reforming a system and what role has civil society played in that? And I think that's where we have seen these trends, where clearly you're 100% right. This whole response to undocumented migrants and immigration detention is so reactive, by states as well, but by governments. It's a reactive response, and in response, civil society gets caught up in a whole range of policy, legislative, or everyday practice issues. What's happening to people? And where the two places that the most change has happened is Belgium that you mentioned and Argentina. There's no question. And you could see this gestation, how groups came together on a shared issue. They work very differently, from very loud public campaigning, you know, outside the detention centre, through to very detailed policy discussions with government. And Argentina was very interesting because the NGOs actually, I mean, they did the whole exposure issue. They really did a lot of work around exposing both legislation, how unjust it was, the due process issues, but also the physical conditions. And Belgium was excellent at that, getting the stories out there of children in particular. But then what is the solution? So many civil society groups get stuck. They get stuck on the problem and they don't take it further. It's very frustrating, particularly for us, because we kind of come in from an outside perspective. So we have a bit of a space to look at it from a position that's not reactive. But I think where we've seen that change, and as Eleanor's saying, what's the way forward? It is where groups have a shared common, it's, you know, multi-pronged strategy, different, I think, you know, everyone has a role to play. Sometimes it is litigation that opens the door, but it may not reform the policy or legislation. There's a next step. I think we need to work out what we want. We need to work out what we want to ask for. And to do that, we need to know what the pressures, the concerns, the political dynamic are on government. So we've actually, just to give a plug, I mean, we've pulled together a lot of those good practices, and it's on the table there just to stimulate some ideas.
Yeah, the last set of questions, there were three. Each of the questions was very relevant. The three issues that I highlighted from those questions was the need for champions, right? We need champions for this issue. The other one was international examples on monitoring. What are some of the best examples? And then the question of New Jersey.
Jersey. New Jersey.
I may avoid New Jersey. But in any case, the need for champions, I think actually this is a really good question internationally. Because when scholars who have looked at how certain activities like slavery became basically prohibited internationally, the story is a similar one in each of these cases, and it is that they got a very powerful country to support this. Now, we're not even anywhere near talking about prohibiting immigration detention internationally. That's not. I think that conversation is not one we're prepared to have. But we could talk about, for example, prohibiting or moving towards cohorts like families, and finding champions among countries that will step up to the plate and say, this is something that's beyond the pale, would be one of the most powerful things that you could do in terms of international advocacy on this issue. And what the IDC did last week at the UN in Geneva was quite impressive. They brought in representatives from two countries which are not hegemonic countries, but Sweden and Belgium, which to talk about how they have limited this or put in alternatives. And that's the kind of thing that we need more of if this issue is going to be carried forward internationally. So finding champions among states would be a very powerful thing to do. Monitoring and best practices. Two countries, very different countries, do the same thing. Lebanon and France. They both have NGOs housed in the facilities. That's the best practice, right? I mean, if you're going to do monitoring and you're going to go and approach authorities and say, this is the way it should be done, you want to look at France. Lebanon is an interesting case for other reasons, but you want to look at France. When I talk about the movement from informal to formal detention regimes, France is a very good case to look at because they did this in the early 1980s. Previously, they had detained very few people in warehouses, and it was very rare that it took place. But when it took place, it caused an outrage in a country whose legacy that it thought about were extermination camps. And it was uncomfortable. So what did they do? They passed a law. They renamed detention retention. And the law, which is quite interesting, and the law said that these facilities were going to have CIMAD, an organization, inside these facilities. And they're there to this day. And amongst European countries, the average length of detention in France is the shortest. Now, average length of detention, why some countries have longer and shorter, there's lots of reasons. But in France, there's a very strong, someone earlier talked about the issue of the constitutionality of this. France, amongst all countries in Europe, and maybe internationally, has a very strong rule of law tradition. And so the constitutionality of every detention order is questioned. And that's a very strong precedent. In the last 5 years, as Grant points out, this has been eroded. Lebanon, and this comes to the other point about how groups can have different agendas and that creates problems with coalitions. Lebanon has a civil society that's very active on the issue of immigration detention. And the Catholic charity Caritas has for several years now had an office in the facility. And the facility is located in a former garage underneath a highway that crisscrosses the city. And the pipes and the air that's coming into that facility are from pipes that are at the highway level. But Caritas is down there.
Don't give the U.S. any ideas now.
this is not best practice. But Caritas is in there, and they have done, I think most people would admit, a pretty good job making sure that there's some humanity in a garage for detainees. But what has happened there's other organizations that have gone into the press and said Caritas is detaining people. Mm. And so this is the kind of tension that can arise. I'm sure it hasn't come to that extent in here in the United States, but there are those kinds of issues. The last question, New Jersey. I mean, the New Jersey questions, the New Jersey example is a really good one, isn't it? Because it is kind of a case in point. There is this issue, we need to improve certain issues, but by doing so, we've actually given incentive to increase this detention capacity of this state. I don't have an answer for practically how to address that issue. It's enormously difficult. And one problem with federal systems, actually, is that, well, that's another question. That's another longer discussion. We can talk about it later. But I don't really have an answer for you. But it's a good case in point. It shows you just how complicated it is to address this issue. You want to, you're like, wow, this is an improvement. We can actually assist our clients. But at the same time, wow, you guys have just built 1,200 beds.
Be careful what you wish for.
So,
okay, we'll take your last two questions.
Thank you very much. My name is Jesse Hawks, and I work for Global Youth Connect. We're an international human rights education and activism organization that does things like bring Rwandans and Americans together to go look at the detention center in Rwanda and interview people there, or come to the United States to look at police systems here. I guess I'm curious about two things. One is really about what are young people doing in this movement, and is social media playing a role for them or for you? And are there any positive examples of social media being used, particularly in the United States? Any campaigns that you think really did a really great job on raising awareness, or anything that was particularly negative? Could talk to that. And the last thing is just a curiosity about whether in the United States the human rights movement is really connected to Andrea's 100 organizations. Is the U.S. Human Rights Network a part of that? And are they talking about the Universal Periodic Review at the UN as a platform for doing the thing that you were talking about, raising the champion, or well, it's not so much it's calling into question the United States, but at least bringing it to the level of the UN. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And your question?
Yeah, the potential inclusion of fiscal conservatives was asked previously, but I don't think it was really addressed. And I was wondering what kind of inroads, if any, have been made both nationally and internationally.
Human rights, U.S., social media. I'll tell you that one case, the case of Yaneli. I don't know how many of you knew about the case of Yaneli, who was detained in Ohio. She was not a dreamer, but she was wanting to go to school, and she was depressed. She had clinical depression, had attempted suicide before being detained, was 23 years old. And there was a whole movement of stop the deportation of Yaneli on social media, and she was deported anyway, which I found fascinating. But even more interesting was, here was a case that was out there, and she too had been lost. Even though they have said, you know, that you can find everyone, this one woman whose case was out there actually also got lost. At some period, for several hours, no one knew where she was. And I was like, God, this is somebody who people are talking about. And she fell through the cracks. And again, so a lot of talk, but she was deported anyway. So.
Well, just to say, I mean, there's a real opportunity right now on this issue internationally at the UN level. I mean, this was not discussed 2 years ago. It was not on any international UN agenda. In 2009, they had the first meeting on immigration detention at the Human Rights Council, which brings together like 160 governments. And since then, there's been a real ripple effect, and we've been trying to really push this issue of good practice, moving away from detaining in the first instance and alternatives. And as Mike said, last week was like a culmination for us, because getting governments to come together and share that children should not be in detention, families should not be in detention, and then to kind of take it further from there as a starting point has been quite profound for us, and it's start of a global strategy over the next coming years. And for us, it is incremental. A lot of governments won't talk about anything else except cost of detention or children or vulnerable groups. They won't engage on, Egypt came last week. We were amazed. They when you start to scratch the surface, you see governments often, they just treat everyone the same, don't really know who's in detention, and then problems start, suicide, health issues, and then you scratch the surface, you see it's a management issue. And so what we've done is pull together and release last week this report on children in immigration detention around the world, which is the stories of children from 20 countries to highlight the impact, but also what the solution is, like a very clear model. The issue then is how to get that out there. So social media for us is really key. I mean, you can talk about the US, but I mean, we're working in countries where, like we were meant to launch, we've launched this campaign last week in 20 countries, including here in the US, in DC. And we were meant to launch in Malaysia. We couldn't because there's no right to public assembly. And there was some fear at the last minute there could be arrests. But social media has taken a whole new form. It's a bit like the Arab Spring. It's become like that is the place young people can come and be connected and in a relatively safe way in places like that. So where I was asking Andrea the same question because we're looking for ideas for the campaign. So I'll leave to you.
Actually, so I want to address the human rights frame first, and then because actually that has created a real opening for us. I think both in terms of using the human rights framework, and then a number of our members have done a really great job working in collaboration with IDC, the Women's Refugee Commission, Human Rights First, Advocates for Human Rights, among others, have done a lot of work and actually have been part of the, you know, we have submitted things to the different UN processes, had hearings with the International IAHRC, International... Thank you, Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, thank you. They did an incredible report on detention, scathing report in response after a number of rounds of hearings that many of our members did. Also the UN Special Rapporteur, several visits. So there's actually been, and that has created space, I think the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights report in particular that came after all of this and has been incredibly helpful in terms of pointing this out at an international level, getting to the point where they're now asking I believe they're sitting down with ICE, with Department of Homeland Security, they're actually engaging in discussions where they're actually asking for data and proof of different things. So it has pushed. I mean, I also think the international piece has helped. I mean, I know you've been able to bring, you know, ICE officials to a number of these meetings and both kind of carrot and stick, right? You've shamed them, but you've also promoted the things that they're kind of doing right. And it has changed their perception, right? We actually think there's a new discussions around alternatives, though we want to be very careful of that definition because of some of the conversations in the international. I want to be very clear that what ICE is calling alternatives to detention is an alternative form of detention, and we got totally co-opted on that, right? That is a form, they have taken over that term and used it for their purposes, which is an example of how we need to, you know, both be working in our very specific policy goals, but have a much bigger framework. So that's something we're now working to address. But I think there has the kind of the new opening with ICE around kind of looking at community support programs has come because of this, the push with international forums and then the collaboration with groups like IDC. So that's been really great. I think I have to say, frankly, we haven't done enough work with youth. You know, there has been some really good work with college students at different times, but they're really... I don't think we've done enough. I'm racking my brain to think of what some of our members may have done, so I apologize if I'm missing anything. But I do think there's more, frankly, it's an issue of capacity, right? In terms of social media, I think there have been, I mean, definitely inroads. I don't know if we've seen a real tipping point around social media. I think the Dreamers have done, I mean, despite the unfortunate results in that young woman's case, a number of Dreamers have been released because of intense individual campaigns. And also the groups of Families for Freedom. Actually, Families for Freedom, which is an amazing network of people directly impacted by detention, they have actually engaged their youth in a number of campaigns. And so that actually is an example of where it can happen. So I feel like we've done social media. I mean, we're excited because we now have social media. We never had it before, and that's thanks to some of our amazing volunteers. But really how to actually use that on a large scale is something that we're really grappling with in terms of capacity. I think really we're looking, even though we've kind of talked and you're asking us about our communications, we're kind of going back to you and asking you about communications.
I still wonder whether having started my day today at a Union City high school, speaking to two senior classes, one in English and then one in Spanish, and mostly predominantly Latino youth, and being up on stage and talking about, look, I know that some of you are experiencing the issues of detention and deportation. And I was watching to see if any of them were like, and they weren't, because there's such an element of shame that we haven't talked about, right? I mean, we can talk about this because we're here, but for them, as a young person in a high school, it's not like, it's taken them to the point where they can say, I'm a dreamer, I'm public, but then to say, and my dad is detained, or was just deported, you know, when we know the statistic that one in four Latinos knows someone or has a family member who has been detained or deported. And yet, so I think that, you know, again, we've got to get to that point where there isn't going to be shame about the fact that this has happened. And that's such a deep and very personal issue. We've got to wrap it up. I think that, Maria Teresa, you want to come back to? I just want to say that for me, you know, as a journalist who's been covering this for over 20 years, it's like you kind of think that things are going to get better, right? That a story that you're advocating, I mean, I'm not an advocate, but that you're watching advocates work and that you've been covering it, you know, since more than 20 years. And it's quite defeating to see that, no, in fact, we've gone backwards. It hasn't gotten better. It's gotten worse. So that is a big kind of cloud that continues to hang over me. So thank you, Maria Teresa and OSI, and for all of you for being here and for having this very first kind of public conversation to my panelists. Thank you. Thank
you. Before I let you all go, and I thank you all, I think the way we get things to continue to improve is precisely by the type of transnational, global discussion that we had. We challenge ourselves when we put this together, because it's always the concern that the audience is mainly coming from that is based in New York here. We wanted to open it up through audio and video, and we were just not able to do that because of a number of other challenges. But I am very satisfied with the level of conversation. And I know we ended up a little bit more, even more questions than comments, but I just see this as one in many more transnational conversations that we can have. That is a role that the International Migration Initiative indeed does, and I'm pleased to have had the type of partnership with U.S. programs on not just this topic and other things that we've done together in the past and we want to do in the future. So it is by this type of comparisons, I think actually we did all, I can maybe assume, we all learned something. And we did... if not as, I don't think that the questions that we were raising have easy answers, and that's exactly what I wanted to get at. I wanted to make sure that we did not end up having another conversation about the problems. We know them, unfortunately, well. It's important to recognize that we need to continue to work together, work across borders, and challenge ourselves as to what the real strategies and solutions are for this amazing problem. But anyway, thank you all for your comments and questions, and thank you for this wonderful panel. Thank you so much.